I'm Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
No one likes us, I don't know why. We may not be perfect, but heaven knows we try. But all around, even our old friends put us down. Let's drop the big one and see what happened.
Randy Newman's music isn't for everybody, especially if you like the kind of background noise that makes no demands on your ears or intellect. But if you prefer all things succinct and sardonic, he's your man.
We'll drop the big one, pulverize them. The Asia's crowded, Europe's too old.
Newman's song, Political Science, still seems eerily appropriate, despite having been written more than 30 years ago. So here's the question to you. Does political thought set to music have more pungency than what you read on the editorial page?
We'll save Australia.
What does Randy Newman's work have to tell us about the risks and rewards of music with a message?
We're building an all-American amusement park there. They got surfing too.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Oscar-winning singer, songwriter, and composer Randy Newman joins me now in our studios in Boston. And I should tell you, he has been writing music since he was 17, including the scores to more than 30 films, which is pretty amazing.
Ooh.
But I want to know first, how is it you could be so predictive? Because you describe Europe as too old long before Donald Rumsfeld was telling us about old Europe. What do you think? He heard you as a...
Well, I never thought, you know, anyone would actually say that. I mean, it's a complaint a really jingoistic American could make. Like, you know, they're old and their day is over, you know. But I never thought anyone would say anything remotely like that. To be fair to him, though, why bother? He said, you know, the old Europe, you know, was against him in this case, and the new Europe, you know, Romania and Poland, and was for him.
What was your take when this song began being not only played but quoted? In the fall of 2003, when it was used as a description of America's arrogance?
Well, this administration and their style is closer to this kind of sort of the guy in this song who's insane, you know, really. I mean, it's closer to that than Goldwater was even or Nixon or Reagan or anyone who may have been, you know, prone to that kind of nationalism. They sort of knew the rules, and these guys, they behave differently. There's sort of a swagger to it. I mean, if you're genuinely a tough guy, you don't have to swagger. The United States, you know, their president doesn't have to walk around like a tough guy. I mean, why bother, you know?
Did it surprise you, though, that people...
Even in prison, they got guns. You know, there's no big tough guys anymore. You know, someone, a little guy with a gun is a tough guy.
Did it surprise you, though, that people remembered the song so well, that they picked it up, that they said, oh, you know, this sounds like something I heard Randy Newman do a while back?
A little bit. But, you know, the debris that ends up in your brain. I mean, I remember sax. You hear yourself singing along with a hit that you liked, and you remember every note of a sax solo of Yakety Yak or something. You know, it's a ton of nonsense in people's heads.
It is amazing how lyrics come back to you, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you began at 17.
Yeah.
You had a couple of uncles who were
songwriters. Three uncles who wrote the occasional song when they had to for a picture, but they were motion picture composers. Alfred, who won 8, 9 Academy Awards, I think, and Lionel won a couple, and Emil, who did some Best Years of Our Lives and all the Sonia Henie movies and Danny Kaye movies.
And so what do you think? You sort of got this by osmosis?
Well, it was there in the family. My father was a doctor. You know, he was the one that went to college, and which you have to do to be a doctor in those days.
I think you still do.
He did, even though it was Alabama and LSU he went to. But he loved the business more than they did, being that they were in it, which I can testify to. You know, it looks better from the outside in some ways, as you may know. But I think he loved it, and maybe he pushed me. I mean, like, I was 6 years old, and I woke up one morning, and there was a piano in my room, you know, in case I was Mozart, you know, would play a third. So it might be because, you know, three of my cousins are composers and film composers, David and Thomas, and who did Angels in America and American Beauty and Finding Nemo. And David does the Danny DeVito movies, and Dr. Doolittle 1, Dr. Doolittle 2. So it's like a bad Bach family, as I've said.
You know? Clearly something going on in the gene pool.
Possibly, yeah. Might be.
I know people want to hear a lot of your music this hour, so we're definitely going to oblige. And I want to start with your first big hit, which was Short People. And
first and last, huh?
Truth be told, not everybody got this one.
Well, it's because it reached a lot of people. I mean, it's so clear. I never thought anyone would think anyone was as insane. This guy's almost more nuts than the political science guy. I mean, no, there's no cabal against short people. I mean, there's no one that hates them that way. It just isn't true.
As one of the vertically challenged, I have to say it never would have occurred to me to be offended by this. And yet, some radio stations wouldn't even play it.
And if they did play it, the minute they got a complaint, they took it off. But it was a number one record, number one and number two, depending on what you read. You know, in retrospect, now that the money's in on it, if you go into junior high school at the time and they're listening to the popular, they're playing your song, and you're sensitive about it, as you were sensitive about everything in junior high, I can understand some kind of, I have some remorse, but not much. You know, I mean, it really is. The thing is, the song, because it was the most successful thing I ever had, unfortunately, it reached people that, you're not used to irony in pop music. There's more of it now in rap, you know, with Outkast or Ludacris, people like that, than there ever was in those days. Words meant what they said. I love you, you don't love me, I hope you love me again someday, then I'll be happy. See, if I wrote like that, I'd be...
There you go.
Living in Kauai in oil painting.
There's another song I want to hear, and that is called Rednecks, and that's sort of your love-hate relationship with the American South. Let's hear a bit of that.
Last night I saw Lester Maddox on a TV show with some smart-ass New York Jew. And the Jew laughed at Lester Maddox, and the audience laughed at Lester Maddox too. Well, he may be a fool, but he's our fool. And if they think they're better than him, they're wrong. So I went to the park and I took some paper along. And that's where I made this song. We talk real funny down here. We drink too much, we laugh too loud. We're too dumb to make it no northern town. We're keeping the niggas down. We got no neck or men from Texas.
All right, let's get a little of your background here, because you grew up in California.
You almost have to hear the whole thing to exonerate me on that, but I'll explain it.
Exactly. I mean, you spent some summers in New Orleans. You actually have a little bit of a drawl, if I'm hearing you properly, and have great fondness,
my mother
actually.
My mother was from New Orleans, never lost her. Except my father went to school at the med school. That's where he met her, in New Orleans, and which is a little frightening, a med school in New Orleans. But they had a good one, you know, at Charity. And I have an interest and a fondness, and this song is about, later on in the song, the guy talks about the free to be put in a cage, about how in the North, what he ends up saying is that it's not really different at this time, and it wasn't, and it isn't. You know, L.A. is segregated to this day.
In other words, it wasn't just a Southern problem.
No, this guy, I saw Lester Maddox on the Dick Cavett Show. This is one of the rare cases when I wrote a song because of something that I immediately saw. And the crowd, like, hooted at Maddox. Now, Maddox was an idiot. Maddox was a bad man, and an evil man, segregationist governor. But these people, they didn't have black friends, you know, the audience in New York. They weren't great civil libertarians. You know, they had no right to not let him speak and make a fool of himself, as he would have done. They brought Jim Brown out, you know, the ex-Cleveland Brown. And I thought that had I been a citizen of Georgia who had elected him or not elected him, irrespective of whether I was the Ralph McGill or whoever I was, I would have been offended by their assumption of moral superiority because they're not really entitled to it. You know.
And is that what took you to the piano? And you said, I'm gonna
write it. It did. I was actually on the road at the time, and I sort of wrote it. Like, I've written two songs like that in my life, and that was one of them.
All right. Well, we want to hear some more of that song because, as promised, you said we have to listen to more of the lyrics to really get it. Any other quick thing you want to tell us about it before we do?
No. It's just that the guy, I cheated a little, and he wouldn't know the name of all these ghettos and, you know, Huff in Cleveland and East St. Louis and Fillmore in San Francisco, but so I cheated.
All right, well, let's listen, and let's also ask our listeners what you hear in Randy Newman's work.
Now, you know the niggas and Negroes. Got his dignity. Down here we too ignorant to realize the North is set the nigger free. Yes, it's free to be put in a cage in Harlem, New York City. It's free to be put in a cage on the south side of Chicago, on the west side. It's free to be put in a cage in Huffington, Cleveland. It's free to be put in a cage in East St. Louis. And it's free to be put in a cage in San Francisco. It's free to be put in a cage in Roxbury and Boston. They're gathering the money for miles around, keeping the niggas down. We're rednecks, we're rednecks.
And we'll be back with more from Randy Newman in just a moment. I'm Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
We're keeping the niggas down. We are keeping the niggas down.
I'm Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. And we're back with Randy Newman in our studios this hour. The music you're listening to is Ragtime. That's his composition for Milos Forman's 1981 film of the same name. So we ask you, what do you hear in the songs of Randy Newman? And have you watched his evolution over the years? Our number is 1-800-423-8255 if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And let's go to Fairfax, South Carolina, and hear what Martin has to say. Hi, Martin.
Hello, Gail. Randy, I'm a transplant from Cleveland to the South.
You don't sound like South Carolina yet.
And I was on hold during the intro when they played Rednecks. And my question is, that album, Good Old Boys, is so empathetic to Southerners in some songs and yet so vitriolic in others. I'm just wondering, what was the reaction that you received from your Southern associates and folks that you knew in down in Louisiana?
Not to mention your Southern kin.
Yeah, it was positive. There's nothing really vitriolic that I can think of. I mean, the song Redneck, the guy, the language he uses is inexcusable in a way, but the point he makes is valid.
Yes, I was thinking about the line, when in dumb, come out dumb too.
Yeah, he doesn't really mean that, you know, about LSU. He's talking about the northern perception, kind of, in a way. So that's why it's too complicated to like my music. You know, it's like, it isn't that hard, but I mean, he's just playing a little bit, you know. Yeah. He's not putting down LSU necessarily.
Yeah, well, my wife and I love the theme from Monk, and God bless you in the future.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the call, Martin.
Thanks, Martin. I also want to hear a very sweet song you wrote, mm-hmm. which did rather well, in addition, that called If I Didn't Have You.
If I were a rich man with a million or two, I'd live in a penthouse in a room with a view. And if I were handsome,
no way
it could happen, 'cause dreams do come true. I wouldn't have nothing if I didn't have you.
And I'll bet you all know that song. It's the Oscar-winning song from Monsters, Inc., If I Didn't Have You. And, boy, that had to be such a big moment for you. 16 nominations, you got up there, and I loved it. You had such a great Randy Newman moment when you said, hey, you know, don't have pity on me. Got all these nominations.
Well, I didn't expect to be up there, and I also didn't expect. I genuinely never cared when I didn't win it. I cared when something bad beat me, but sometimes if it was John Williams or Grusin or Horner or whatever did beat me, somebody good, it never bothered me, because I've been watching it for so long. My uncle was nominated, you know, 70 times or something, and my uncles have been. And it isn't based on merit, you know. Sometimes, I mean, I get to vote for costume design, and you know, look what I'm wearing, and. Cinematography, things I know nothing about, and they don't know anything about necessarily music, particularly film music. So I didn't think if I did win, it would mean it. But when I got out there, I was really moved. You know, the orchestra stood up and the audience stood up. You know, if they like me so much, why didn't they give it to me earlier? You know?
What took them so
but
long?
And, you know, Jennifer Lopez was out there getting the award, but she was all fuzzy-headed. You know, my eyes were bad. I wasn't sure that was she. I thought it was like some award girl, you know, that I don't know, it was confusing. But I was moved by the being out there. I had no idea what I would say. And
So that just popped into your head?
Oh, yeah. I didn't think I'd win. I thought McCartney or Sting or somebody would win.
So no little note cards in your pocket?
No, not a thing. Never. I never had any expectations. I thought I might have won for The Natural. I thought I might have won for Toy Story or Toy Story 2, but don't know.
Mm. Let's hear now from Philip, who's on the line from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Hello, Philip.
Good morning. Thank you for the wonderful warmth and intelligence that you bring to your work.
Thank you.
I've been a huge fan of yours all my life, as long as you've been writing music. I love the way you sing. I think it takes a lot of nerve for you to sing your own song sometimes, but I think to begin with, but you sing your work better than anybody else.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That's nice.
I just wanted to bring up something about your, do you think that there's a future for protest music or music with a message? When I was a little kid, we went to a little diner in Mississippi. And on that jukebox, there were some really racist songs, little 45s. This was back in the early
50s. Yeah.
So that's, you can't find that anymore. But on the other side of it, that song Rednecks, I don't think it got a whole lot of radio play.
No, it was played. It didn't. In fact, the one station I know of that played it was here in Boston. And it was during the busing crisis, and they took it off the air. And I understood it, you know, the Louise Day Hicks thing they had up here. As to your question about whether there's a future for it, basically, I don't think so. I mean, I was listening to radio station somewhere, I can't remember where I was, and I heard, like, it was AC/DC, you know, like a seminal hit, Moody Blues, Procol Harum. Then they played Jackson Browne, and it was sort of politically oriented, and it really sounded like an aberration. It sounded good to me. And I think in rap there may be room for lots of stuff, you know, protesting rather than just bragging. Because there's room for irony in rap as there has never been before. There's more people that are closer to what I have done than now than there ever have been. It's different.
Well, Willie Nelson wrote a protest song. He wrote a song about freedoms. He was watching the Super Bowl, and he just got up and went over and wrote a song. It was published, the lyrics were published in a Memphis newspaper by a Memphis reporter. And I don't know that the song has been recorded or that it's going to be released, but it was a political song with a message. And
there may always be a niche for it, but it's always going to be, as it's been for 400 years, love songs. 95% of it has been that way, and it's basically sort of going to stay that way. You know, it's very hard to write a serious song about a serious subject. I mean, they make war movies, anti-war movies. I mean, it's like hitting the ground when you fall out of an airplane. War is bad. But the song like The Universal Soldier is like a great song, but they're very difficult and rare. I mean, that's why I've chosen a different way to do it. So I think there's room, but I wouldn't expect to hear it very often. You know, it just isn't what people like.
Philip, thank you so much for the phone call. I want to go to one of your other songs, Randy. It's sort of from the darker side. Mm. This is about why I love mankind. You call it God's song.
Yeah.
Powerful stuff.
Yeah.
I have to wonder, what was going on in your life at that time?
Oh, nothing. I think what goes on in my life doesn't have much to do with what I do in the little room, you know, when I'm writing. I mean, I can write happy stuff when I'm feeling bad. And it's a different world to me. It doesn't matter where I am or what the nature of the room is. That's just a song about how people can possibly maintain their belief in God when all these horrible things happen. The answer that you can't argue with is his ways are mysterious. And I could only say, you know, I'll say. And you know, that we don't know what he has in mind when the 39 Peruvian kids go off a cliff in the bus, you know. And so that's what that song's about. I think I'm, you know, that's off the new record. I think I'm singing better now than when I listen to that old stuff. I think I'm singing better now than I did then.
Mm.
Why, I don't know.
Do you think that you are getting more mellow with time? Or, as you say, it really has absolutely nothing to do with time or place or circumstance?
Oh, inevitably. Inevitably. I mean, you hear records now, like by James Taylor or Tom Petty, where they're making almost no noise at all. I hope I'm not getting more mellow. But it seems to head it. But you know what? That's the last song you played. People don't really listen to music that way. I mean, if you don't listen to that song, like, sit and listen to it, it's no good for, like, having a party, you know, if you're, like, eating potato chips and drinking Pepsi. It's not like Norah Jones, you know, whatever the quality of it may be great stuff, but it goes fine at a party or a restaurant or Diana Krall. I mean, in Europe, I was just in Europe, at every restaurant was Norah Jones and Diana Krall. They wouldn't be happy about it because they're serious. But even I, when I'm listening to music, unless I have the score, I mean, I don't even listen to Beethoven that way. I mean, I'm moving around doing this, that, or the other. You know, if I got a score, I'll sit and listen. But it's funny, you don't listen to, there's very few people that sit and listen to music and do nothing else. So I kind of picked the wrong medium if I wanted to, you know, if I wanted to be really paid attention to. But it's the only thing I got, so.
Well, we're listening, and you're listening.
I appreciate it.
To The Connection from NPR. Want to go back to our phone lines now, this time to Charlottesville, Virginia, where Jim's on the line. Hello, Jim.
Hi, how you doing? Hey, Randy, I just want to tell you I'm a big fan.
Thank you.
And I'm real pleased to see that you're getting the awards that you've deserved for a long
time. Thank you. It's a nice town you live in.
Oh, yeah, it's a great place. Yeah. It's really a wonderful place. I have a question that's it's going to take me a second to get to it, maybe. But what I wanted to ask you about was the use of irony generally, okay?
Yeah.
And that it seems to me that I had an Israeli friend who called irony the weapon of the weak.
Mm.
Weak, W-E-A-K, weak.
Yeah.
And one of the things that it seems to me, and it, looking at the history of some of your songs, and how they've been turned against their original intention.
Mm.
I'm wondering if that's not sort of inherent in the use of irony, that it gets co-opted for the opposite, since you're asking people to make that sort of intellectual leap to go against what the words are saying. It's real easy to co-opt ironic songs and say, no, this is really talking about what the U.S. is really like. It's in praise of what the U.S. is, the arrogance of the United States.
But I think that's a mistake. I mean, it's if I've done my job correctly, the protagonist of political science saying, you know, boom goes London, boom Paris. Sure. I mean, how can you turn that and say, are you serious? I've had one person ask me, a newspaper person once, well, are you serious with political science? Only one. If you do, the line is clearly marked. As a matter of fact, I like it when there's more ambiguity. I've got a song called Follow the Flag that's really close to the line, whether I believe what the guy is in the song or not. And I like it there. So I don't know if what I do is, whether irony is exactly what I do. Like God's song, I mean, that's the words, you know, that I put in God's mouth. Man means nothing. He means nothing. He's not being ironic. He's telling him what he feels about him. I never, you know, when in school when you get a poem and they say someone would analyze it this way. Some kid said, no, I think it's about the moon. Another kid say, no, it's about gardening in Sussex. And that's right. The teacher will say, that's right. That's right. Well, I know what I mean. You know, and I like people to get that. It may be selfish of me and hopeless, but if I've done my job well, it should be clear that political science, that I don't believe that Europe's too old or that South America stole our name.
So what is it? What is it that means you've done your job well? That it's just kind of, I like that real sort of bouncy, you know, boom goes London.
Yeah, that if people get mainly that's very close to being just a comedic song. It's so far to the right, I would have thought. It means that kind of jingoism is ridiculous, is you know, and the stupidity of saving Australia just because it's got cute things like kangaroos and surfing is there's something American about it, you know, there's nothing American about being that loony. I mean, there are Americans who are that crazy, but not many.
All right, Jim, thank you so much for the phone call. We're talking this hour with Randy Newman, and as we go into a break, you're going to hear You've Got a Friend in Me from the 1995 film Toy Story. And we ask, are you hearing a kinder, gentler Randy Newman these days? And if so, do you miss the more acerbic one? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection from NPR.
You've got a friend in me. When the road looks rough ahead and you're miles and miles from your nice warm bed, you just remember what your old past said. Boy, you got a friend in me. Yeah, you've got a friend in me. You got a friend in me. You got a friend in me. You got trouble, and I got them too. There isn't anything I wouldn't do for you. We stick together, see it through.
I'm Gail Harris, and for Dick Gordon, this is The Connection. Continuing our conversation this hour with composer and vocalist Randy Newman, who has won an Oscar, an Emmy, and 4 Grammy Awards over a 40-plus year career. Many of his songs have been recorded by other people, too, including the one we're hearing now, a love song of sorts to a hooker, which was also recorded by Tom Jones in 1972 and by Joe Cocker when his 1986 version was featured in the film 9 1/2 Weeks. And Randy, I have to say,
first paragraph of my obituary
will be that.
That's what
right?
It'll be. Oscar winner, you know, for my, you know, a sort of minor league song.
Well, but let's talk about this one for a second,
yeah.
Because I like your version the best. When you hear other people do your music, do you cringe a little bit, or do you think,
know, the Cocker and Jones, sometimes I cringe, but I mean, I'm happy they're doing it. And Cocker and Jones, they did it. I mean, I did it low down, and, you know, the guy, it isn't like serious. He's kind of weak in some kind of ways, but it's low down and kind of sleazy. I didn't see the girl as a hooker necessarily. But they did it, you know, six keys higher. I mean, they did it up in C, which I could have done. I didn't think of it. But I sort of, now that I hear it again with you here today, I mean, I do like it better, kind of low down and
honky-tonk.
Yeah, and not, they did it up high. They got big, beautiful voices, you know. But I could have done it up there. I just, and maybe had a hit, but I didn't, I didn't realize, you know, until I heard them do it.
Is that a painful part of the process to write something and then kind of send it out into the world and,
no,
and other people can do what they want?
No, it isn't at all. I mean, you know, you get all kinds. You get Nina Simone doing Baltimore in a real different way and, you know, an interesting way. Or ancient, you know, record by Cilla Black that was very good of a song of mine. Alan Price did a bunch of them. Harry Nilsson did a bunch of them very well. Ronstadt did some very well. So, I mean, it works both ways. I mean, that's the business I'm in. And Bonnie Raitt's always done great by me. So there's bad ones and there's some good ones.
And one of my personal favorites, Three Dog Nights, Mama Told Me Not to Come.
Yeah, and they made it a hit. I mean, I didn't have a hook like, I don't have that talent. You know, it is a talent. It's nothing to be, it isn't like I'm writing better than Barry Manilow necessarily because he can write hit after hit. But it's a different talent, definitely, you know. Elton John's got that talent, and he writes good stuff, too. I don't think I do, you know. And I don't have the voice that I'm, the instrument I'm writing for isn't going to get to Mandy, you know. Mandy, you know, I mean, I can't do it, you know. I mean,
should we all be devoutly grateful for that?
Even with, no, I mean, I like it. You know, those things are, someone was talking to me about the ABBA show, and they liked it, and they're sort of embarrassed for liking it. Well, I mean, ABBA stuff is kind of irresistible, you know, dancing, but I'm not going to write that for me. I can't say those words. The winner stands small, the loser stands tall, you know. And not even when they, I just don't have the kind of voice. I don't see myself that way, you know.
All right, let's go to Pat now, who's on the line from Wellesley, Massachusetts.
Ooh,
hello, Pat.
Northerner.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm thrilled to get a chance to talk to you. I've been a fan for years.
Well, thank you.
You're talking about not really writing these everyday songs like ABBA does, but I'm thinking of some of your love songs, specifically Feels Like Home.
Yeah.
And wondering how you rate that compared to your other things, and wondering also if you did record that one.
I did it. It's like a demo version of it that I did. It's on that Guilty, that four-disc set. But I wrote it for Bonnie, for Faust.
Uh-huh.
And it's going to end up as one of the most popular songs that I've ever written. And yet, because you know, people love it, even
great,
you know,
song,
fans of mine, and it's so atypical of what I usually do.
Mm-hmm. I found it when looking for something for a friend of mine that was getting married to an old school friend at the age of 55,
yeah,
and was thrilled to find that you had written it.
Oh,
that's extra bonus.
Very nice.
Not
thank
only that,
you.
But Randy Newman wrote this.
Yeah, wow. Very nice. I don't write. I'd live in a bigger house if I wrote more of those, you know, but I wouldn't write it unless I were writing it for Bonnie. I mean, you're not going to write God Song or Redneck for Disney or for Bonnie Raitt. I mean, they got careers to think about and motion pictures and children that will come to see Toy Story. You're not going to say, you know, do most of the stuff that I am prone to do. So if I'm writing a song for Bonnie Raitt, you want to have a bit of a hook to it, you know.
Thanks, Pat. To Dan now, who's joining us from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Hello, Dan.
Hello, Randy. It's great to hear your voice.
Well, thank
I saw you,
Dan. You
at the State Capitol Dragway 25 years ago over in Baton Rouge, and just loved you for many years. I think one of the things that I'd like to hear you comment about is it seems to me most of your music has a certain humility to it, and I don't know whether that makes it Southern or what. Southern sensibility certainly does. I think part of that would say that, you know, you're not better than anybody else, but what I've always loved about your music is that it does say that, you know, everybody's the same. We're not, one's not better than the other, and it's a great lesson, I think, for all of us.
Well, I've tried not to separate myself like I'm the artist or I'm up there here talking to you down there. It isn't conscious particularly, but I mean in general, of course I feel that way. You know, I didn't live long enough in the South to acquire the great manners they have there, nor did they anywhere else in this country. They don't have manners like they do in the South. But, yeah, I don't feel as if I'm, God knows, any better than anyone to whom I'm singing. And I think I respect the audience's intelligence. I always expect that the audience will realize that the people in my songs are defective in some way, like the leave your hat on guy ordering the girl around, in a weak way, admittedly. But in other songs, the political science guy would talk about short people. I always expect the audience is better than the people I'm writing about. I've run into too often, you know, particularly in the movie business, where people think the audiences are stupid and that they have to lead them along and let them know this is a joke. We may not be good at algebra here. We may not be as good as the Belgians. But at movies, I mean, we're great. There's a thing in the first Star Wars Lucas made in a long time, which I couldn't follow at all. And when I could follow it, I didn't like it. But in any case, I'm looking at it, and toward the end of the movie, they say to someone, you've got to go to the next galaxy and tell them everything you saw there. And I laughed. You know, I said, are you kidding? That's the toughest assignment I ever heard of. But my little boy was sitting next to me. Said, shut up. You don't even, because he knew everything. You know, so what can I say? I hesitate to brag like this, but I have utmost respect for the intelligence of the audience to whom I'm playing. And I think they couldn't get what I do. You know, I mean, it's not that hard.
Dan, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky now and hear from David. Hello, David.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Randy, I've loved your music since I reviewed Good Old Boys for my high school newspaper.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
And my question, I guess, relates to the last comment you made. You've been talking a lot about irony in your music, and people who seem to have no trouble at all with irony and other forms of entertainment or art, like movies or editorial cartoons or things like that, seem to just be stumped by it when it comes to popular music.
All right, David, thank you so much for the call. You're listening to The Connection from NPR.
Well, I think, David, you know, they don't expect it maybe in pop music. I mean, The Simpsons is popular. Simpsons is maybe the best comedy and certainly the most ironic comedy that television's ever had. They get Frasier, you know. They get things on television that are movies that are ironic. Maybe when you're driving in a car and listening to car radio, irony's tough to pick up at 80 miles an hour. You know, I said, oh, he's being ironic. It's a different thing. You know, the beat is such a powerful thing. Usually I play by myself, you know, just piano and me. But I went out with a band a few times, and it was fun, you know, because we could rock and roll. But I'd lose laughs. Because there's something so powerful about just beating your foot and moving to music that it just blows the brain out. It's the biggest thing in music of the century. You know, Stravinsky, from Stravinsky to Steve Miller. It's like, that's what it's been about, really. That may be part of it. It may be, it's the medium where it's the most difficult to get. But like I say, and say at length today, Outkast, you know, Ludacris, I mean, they make it clearer. They're being ironic, but you kind of get it.
David, I'm wondering if you have a favorite Randy Newman song.
Oh, that would be hard to say, but maybe you asked before if we miss the old, more acerbic Randy Newman, and definitely do not. Bad Love is like one of my favorites of all time.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites of the ones I've done.
Just a brilliant album. And, of course, my kids love all your Pixar music, and I do too.
Thank you.
Got a Friend in Me has been a bedtime song for years.
Hmm. Oh, that's very nice to
hear. But I don't know, maybe Wedding in Cherokee County.
Odd song, all right.
Somebody wrote that song to me just still kind of amazes me.
It amazes me, too. Some of the stuff I said, you know, I just don't know what I was thinking of. But thank you.
David, thanks so much for the call. I'm wondering, Randy, how do you know when you've written something really good? I mean, are you at the point now where you get that sense so that if you like it, then chances are the rest of the world, or at least all those people whose opinions you care about, are going to agree? Or is there always that question mark until you get some feedback?
When I write something I really like, I know, yeah. I know that I like it. I'm tougher on myself than anyone else is likely to be in some ways. You know, I mean, and when I write something like "The World Isn't Fair" from Bad Love, or "Great Nations of Europe," there, or "Shame," I mean, I know that it's about the best I can do, and I'm real happy that I was doing it at 55 or whatever I was when I wrote that last record. Because you're not sure. I mean, in rock and roll, it looks like people do their best work very early. It's like chess and physics, but stupider. And I didn't know when I sat down to write in 54, 55, whether I could do anything that was as good as what I'd done before. But I was satisfied that it was. I also wrote a song on there called "I'm Dead, But I Don't Know It," which also may be the case. Because, you know, no one's retiring. Everyone who was out on the road in 72 is out there now. It's an odd phenomenon. You know?
Well, we are so glad that you're alive, and we know it, and we're so happy to have had you in
more
the studio
or less,
with us.
Yeah,
this
thank you.
I can attest to it, absolutely, Randy Newman. Thanks so much.
It's a pleasure.
We're going to close the program by hearing "Louisiana 1927." That's a song from 1974. But first, also want to tell you that Randy Newman's newest CD is "The Randy Newman Songbook, Volume 1." Tara Murphy is our senior producer, and you can continue the conversation on theconnection.org. I'm Gail Harrison for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection.
What has happened down here? Is the wind have changed? Clouds roll in from the north and it start to rain. Rained real hard and it rained for a real long time. 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline. River rose all day, the river rose all night. Lost in the